This episode of the DTFH has been brought to you by Quince. Oh my God, it's so great. I'm out here in Texas, and it's finally starting to get cold. Right now, it's a crisp 80 degrees out there, but yesterday, it was like 50 degrees. It's so nice. I can finally start wearing sweaters again, long sleeve, denims, and even better, I'm waiting for my $50 Mongolian cashmere sweater from Quince. Mongolian cashmere for only 50 bucks. You got to check Quince out. Winter is not just coming, it's here, friends. And they've got everything that you could want. And even better, by partnering directly with ethical factories and top artisans, Quince cuts out the middleman to deliver premium quality at half the cost of the other high-end brands. So you can give luxury quality pieces without the luxury price tag. Also, it's the giving season, and I'm sorry, but I'm not going to stores anymore. No way. I'm past that part of my life. Quince has got everything you need. You don't have to go on some horrific shopping expedition that's going to leave you with some kind of long-term PTSD. You could just go online, go to Quince, and give your loved ones something beautiful. They're going to think you went into deep credit card debt for this stuff, but it's reasonably priced, and it's beautiful, and it gets the Aaron Trussell seal of approval. That's my wife. She loves it. Give and get timeless holiday staples that last this season with Quince. Go to quince.com/Duncan for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/Duncan. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/Duncan. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by MeUndies.com. Go to MeUndies.com/Duncan to get 20% off the softest pair of underwear this side of paradise. Hello, friends. It's me, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. And for those of you who are new to the podcast, the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast is also known as America's number one math podcast. I hope you're a fan of math, because that's all we do here. Math talk all day, all night. We love math, and today we're going to be focusing on the strange thing that happens when you put a 9 at the end of an imaginary number and subtract it by 7,000 over the root of said number. How, when you do that, it opens up a portal to the math realm where, for a few seconds, you can actually witness the lord of math, Plorg, a trembling maggot-like larva thing that howls numbers out into the void. These are the numbers that land inside of scientific calculators, and if it wasn't for the anguish of Plorg, we would have no math. Let's get going with the show.
Trembling lord of maggots, screaming numbers into time. If we do enough calculations, our souls will never die. Numbers are the only truth in a world of lies. Every number, another name for the Lord of Flies.
Friends, in truth, we have such an incredible show for you today that I've actually had to add a synth track underneath me talking about the upcoming show, because this show that you're about to listen to is steeped in the occult, one of my favorite topics. This show is not only about the tarot, but about the way ancient symbols imbued with mythical power have made their way into every aspect of modern society. If you're allergic to the occult, my friends, I recommend that you rip those earbuds out and replace them with cloves of garlic, because this son of a gun is going to make your occult-phobic skin break out in stigmata. Otherwise, stay tuned. We're going to jump right into it after some very quick business. What do you guys think of my new sound bed technique? I was listening to podcasts and realized that a lot of podcasts are using sound beds, because when you have a sound bed, it sort of creates the impression that you're on the precipice of some monumental epiphanous moment, some revelation, some new thing. Kind of tells you, like, this is where you should definitely be listening. The sound bed is to a podcast what the underline is to a book. It's a way to really emphatically declare that this is it. This moment right now, this thing that you're hearing at this very moment is supremely important. And if you're a person who has genitals and likes to wear underwear, then this is going to be the most important moment of your life. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by MeUndies.com. If you go to MeUndies.com/Duncan, you're going to get 20% off of your first order, an order of the softest underwear that you've ever felt in your life. Have you ever wondered what it might be like to be laying naked in some mythological grove and taking a nap and to have a unicorn wander into that grove and wrap its unicorn tongue around your buttocks and groin? Then you're going to love MeUndies because it feels exactly like you are being held in the firm yet mystically soft grip of a unicorn's tongue. I've never felt anything like this before. I'm wearing a pair of MeUndies right now. They're made from modal, a fabric that's 3 times softer than cotton. Cotton can kiss your ass, friends, because your ass is now being embraced with modal. And if you don't like your first pair, MeUndies will pay you back and you can keep it for free. Do you realize what that means? Right now, order a pair of MeUndies. They send it to you. You send them an email or call them, say, I don't like these underwear. They feel too good. I'm a puritanical Quaker type, and I like my genitals to be in a constant state of agony, which is why, in general, the kind of underwear that I wear is made of fire ants whose antennae have been glued together so that they're especially angry and they sting me all day long. I do not want soft, luxurious, king-like or queen-like underwear gently caressing the most sensitive parts of my body. I want to hurt MeUndies, so I don't like these. MeUndies, you don't even have to send your underwear back. You don't even have to box up those sweaty, oily things and send them back. You get to keep them, no questions asked. It's essentially a free pair of underwear. But you're not going to want to send them back because they're awesome. I actually know how many pairs of MeUndies I own because I like them that much. I own 4 pairs of MeUndies underwear. Wish I had more. Wish my entire body was constantly covered in MeUndies underwear. I wish the entire planet was wrapped in modal. I wish the whole planet was wearing a beautifully designed paisley pair of MeUndies underwear instead of the current conglomeration of water and gravel and mountains. Make sure you go to MeUndies.com/Duncan. You'll get 20% off your first order. Friends, I don't recommend stuff that I don't like, and I really do like this stuff. If you want to get a great present for somebody, or if you just want to get a great present for yourself, MeUndies is where it's at. A big thanks to all of you who continue to use our very important Amazon link, which is located at duncantrussell.com in the comments section of any one of these episodes. It's happening, man. Whether you like it or not, you're about to get sucked into the materialistic updraft of the consensus reality known as Christmas. That means you've got to get some kind of plastic configuration to show people that you love them. And the best way to do that is by going through the Amazon link located at duncantrussell.com. Anything that you buy on Amazon, they will give us a very small percentage of, and it costs you not a thing. It's a great way for you to support this podcast while stocking up on bits of stuff to give to people and show them that you truly love them. Because you know what doesn't show someone that you love them? Doing something nice for them, calling them, giving them unconditional love. Not anymore, my friends. The only true way to express love in this world is to hand someone something they're going to forget about in a few weeks. That's called materialism, and that's the religion of the day. So make sure you go through our Amazon link and celebrate materialism, such a beautiful and wonderful way of life. We also have lots of t-shirts, posters, pins, And I've got some a very special limited edition thing coming into the shop. You know what? I'll just say it, even though it's not up there yet, because it's getting handmade right now by a genius friend of mine. But we have these new DTFH. It's a limited edition. We only made 10 of these things so far, because they take a long time to make. They're handmade, but we have these limited edition, beautiful LED Duncan Trussell Family Hour logo lamps that are the most incredible things I've ever seen. I have one sitting here right now. I'm gazing at its beauty, but they take a long time to make. Wanted to get them up in the shop sooner, but keep your eyes peeled for that because we're only going to have a few of them on sale. And here is a big, big announcement. As many of you know, I am moving to New York City. And to celebrate that, I'm going to be doing a live DTFH podcast at the Bell House in Brooklyn on January the 17th. If you go to duncantrussell.com and scroll down underneath upcoming tour dates, you will see a link for tickets there, or you can go to the Bell House's website. Today's guest has been a writer on many seasons of Adventure Time. He also has an incredible graphic novel called Forming. He is a brilliant artist, and not only that, and he might not like me calling him this, but he is an expert on the tarot and the occult. He's an amazing human, and this conversation is the reason that I love doing podcasts. Everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, Jesse Moynihan.
Too many conflicting ideologies.
Jesse, welcome back to the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we got in a phone conversation, a week ago, and a half ago, and we started talking about the tarot and the occult, and I realized that you are someone who has been, apparently does more than dabbles in this kind of stuff. You seem to have a deep understanding of the tarot. And how did this all start?
Well, I'd say I don't know if I have a deep understanding of the tarot, but I would say that I have a active curiosity in the tarot and in the occult and how it informs my storytelling, I think.
Okay. So it's in that a lot of people say that's one of the main uses for that is not casting spells or like doing Doctor Strange stuff, but is a kind of way to tune into your creative self.
Yeah. Although I am into the casting spells part, but like, I think it started my interest in the tarot in particular started because I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's also a comic book artist named Dash Shaw. And we were at a book, LA Times Book Awards or something. I remember it was at this award ceremony. He was nominated and for some reason he brought up tarot cards and I was reading Manly P. Hall and stuff like that at that time. And Jodorowsky's books and stuff, his like memoirs and that kind of thing. And, he brought up the tarot. He's like, are you into tarot? And I was like, I mean, I read about it sort of, you know what I mean? But I didn't know what it was really, except I wasn't familiar with it, deeply, you know? And, then he explained it to me in this way that made sense to a person who does comics. And, he was like, I think if you do comics, this is my memory now of our conversation, but he was like, I think if you do comics, you should be interested in tarot, because it's this like 78 card system that any way you configure it, it tells a story, and it tells a new story every time. And it gives you insight into yourself. And, I think what I got out of from that conversation was that there was this system that was so, it was like created by some insane, you know, collective genius, and it never been accomplished before and, has never been topped since. It's just this amazing work of art that is, able to tap into your subconscious understanding. You know, it's like I don't know. I keep exploring it and keep trying to learn more and more about it, because the more I learn, the more it blows my mind.
Yeah. What are the theories about the origination of the tarot?
There's a lot of theories, and there's a lot of people disproving those theories. So it's hard to know exactly for sure. All I know is that I think the first record of tarot cards being used or requested by the bourgeois, aristocrats being like, make me a deck, whatever, to the local artist, mm-hmm. was somewhere in the late 1300s or the early 1400s. And then there's theories about people saying it originated in ancient Egypt and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Yeah, there's all these theories about that, but those theories were based on a untranslated document. Was it the Rosetta Stone?
I don't know.
When people were able to translate hieroglyphics, all of those theories sort of like went out the window. Now, some people might be like, fuck you.
Yeah, right.
to that, like to me saying that or whatever, but that's just based on my research. So all I go with is, my thought is, the tarot evolved from playing cards. Playing cards emerged in the documented, probably have been coming around for years and years earlier, but documented, I think, somewhere in the early 1300s is the first someone talking about playing cards and using them in gambling and being like, don't use those things or whatever. And then after that, tarot emerged. But the imagery in the tarot is based on ancient concepts, ancient archetypes, you know?
Yes.
So you could say, yeah, maybe the cards came into existence around the 1400s, mid-1400s or something, but the ideas within those cards are ancient, you know? So,
and someone, I mean, the interesting thing about you, I wish that we were filming this, Jesse brought over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 decks of tarot cards. And what's interesting about it is there's pretty much in every single deck, the exact same symbols emerge.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Like variations on them, yeah. Except for in this grand Atiella deck.
The Egyptian Gypsies Tarot.
Yeah. That one was developed by this sort of enigmatic character. There was a bunch of people that appeared around the same time who... I think this was in the mid-1700s, who sort of reignited interest in tarot cards, not just
right.
for card games, because people are using them as card games. And maybe sometimes some people were using them for cartomancy. But that guy, the Atiella, who is just his name backwards, that was his, like, alias.
Oh, okay.
Him and this guy Pappus and this guy, what was his name? Court de Gobelin. I don't know how to say his name.
Yeah.
They pushed this theory that the tarot was this magic system that could divine the future. And so he reinterpreted those cards to work in conjunction with the, Kabbalah and
so
all
the this the Grand Atiella this yeah. was for cartomancy.
Yeah, that was for divining the future. That, you know, he became a superstar in that scene, you know, or he created that scene.
Well, what? This is what I heard about the tarot at Burning Man.
Yeah, sure.
So what I heard is that, and I thought it was really cool, is that the idea is, so there was this, the Library of Alexandria.
Yeah.
And there's all this information in there.
Yeah.
Or like ancient wisdom, traditions that no longer exist on this planet. And there was has been a concerted effort mm-hmm. to wipe this information out of the popular consensus reality for mm-hmm. some reason or another. It's because it's too powerful, or it it takes your eyes away from the king mm-hmm. and turns your eyes in the direction of the transcendent or something. Who knows? There are varying reasons.
Yeah.
Just control. It's power. So they wanted to figure out a way to take the information that they could remember from the Library of Alexandria, from this world religion or world philosophy, mm-hmm. and condense it down and hide it. And mm-hmm. so they thought the best way to hide it is mm-hmm. make it seem like a card game.
Yeah.
So that then people would just think, oh, people are just playing cards. It doesn't really mean anything. Mm-hmm. But embedded within these cards mm-hmm. is the wisdom of the ages. That's not what I heard. You don't think that's it?
I mean, that goes back really far. I don't know. I think the images, I mean, those images have lasted the test of time. You know, the images that are in there are these eternal. Today, you look at these old images that, you know, of popes and of death and of, you know, towers being hit by lightning and stuff. Yeah. This is all these ancient, old images, but today we still identify with them for some reason. Right. We don't have to update them to be like computers or whatever. Like your iPhone is a new, I mean, people do those cards.
Yeah. I don't like them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I usually don't like the modern tarot cards. They're annoying. Like I prefer let's just grab the card on the top of the deck here. Yeah. The chariot.
Yeah. And that's the Arthur Edward Waite deck that you're.
Which is it? This seems that this version of the Arthur Edward Waite deck. This is I've never seen this. It's a different back than what I've seen.
I don't know.
Usually, but so this the chariot card. Mm-hmm. What I love about it is, yeah, I can kind of intuit from looking at it maybe what the card means. But when you start reading about it, I mean, I'm sure you could tell me. Can you talk about can you describe the card to the listeners and then talk about what all the different pieces mean?
Yeah, there's a knight, and he's got this armor with two moons on him, and one is frowning and one is smiling, and he's coming out of a block of concrete. He's not sitting in the chariot, he's like a part of the chariot. So he's like emerging out of a square basically, and his arms are on the square like a triangle. So that's the symbol. You can read into it as the symbol of the triangle over the square. It's sort of like spirit trying to move away from the material world, or like having the ambition of this high-minded ambition of transcendence, you know? And he's being in this deck, it's ambiguous what the wheels are doing exactly. But in the Marseille deck, the older deck, the one, that emerged in around the, I think, 1500s, the wheels are embedded in the ground. And so that's supposed to mean, it's not supposed to mean anything. It can mean whatever you want, right? But to me, that means that the chariot, the groundedness of the square in the earth, and his movement isn't determined by the wheels of his own chariot. He's actually a part of the planet, and the planet's moving in the celestial sky, you know. So his energy is, the grounded energy is like planetary, you know. So it's a really powerful card.
The chariot is planet Earth.
Yeah, or moving with the cosmos, you know. You're not, it's not like a guy. It's much more powerful than an individual.
I never knew that about the chariot.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always thought that as a guy riding a chariot, I never noticed that. And that's what's, to me, this is, may I see the card?
Yeah, yeah.
This is what's so beautiful about these things is that
there's... Also, he's being, not to interrupt you, but he's being pulled by, in that card, he's being pulled by two sphinxes, right?
Yeah.
And who are sitting. They're stationary.
Wow, right.
You know? So they're not going anywhere. And one is black and one is white. And you could interpret that as the passive and active principles, decisions you have to make in life, being either a witness or a participant, or, you know, both, not value judging either of those things, you know, but it depends on what the question is and all that kind of stuff.
There's a sort of like, what is that called? The flying eye, the sun.
Oh, the globe and the winged wings. Globe. Yeah, that's like an ancient Egyptian symbol.
Right above this top, this like...
Yeah, that's like the, what I understand that is a sexual unity of like man and women, like I forget the name of it. I forget.
The anima and the animus.
The lingam.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And what did they say anything about the city behind the?
I can't remember what the deal is with the city behind it. It really depends on, you know, you can look at these cards and not know anything about them and be able to read them, you know, depending on your intuition and the questions being asked. So you don't have to like know everything about every.
But every card is a meditation. Like yeah. What's cool about it is it is definitely condensed data. Like every mm-hmm. single card, mm-hmm. these are, you know what it is? These are like the old punch cards that people used to put into computers. You uh-huh. know, it's like that's what it does for the human mind when you start just that idea of like the passive, the active. Don't value judge either one of these. Mm-hmm. This the chariot's not even moving. Then you get into like the illusion of movement, like the idea of like what, because I already the card already tricked me.
Yeah, yeah.
For my entire life, the card's been tricking me.
And well, me too, man. The more I do research on these cards, I've been cross-referencing, because I'm working on my own deck, right, as a means of understanding the cards cool. better. And so each deck, I have a bookshelf of books that I cross-reference all the different theories about what the meanings are, what the origins are of the images, and like how they developed over time into the... That Rider-Waite is a far development beyond like the original. They call that the esoteric deck and the original like Marseille deck, or it's not the original, but it's like the first mass printed deck. They call the exoteric deck. So
okay,
it's there's all this stuff on the surface. It's less imbued with occult imagery, you know, the Marseille deck.
Yeah.
Whereas the Rider-Waite deck. Has so much like the chariot deck in the Marseille is just two horses. It's not two sphinxes, like for example. But right. you can still, I personally read from the Marseille deck because I feel like it's more open. There's a lot more freedom to interpret for me anyway.
Oh, that's cool. So you don't like the there's too many symbols in this deck for you.
To me, I think some of the, there's too many esoteric symbols in the deck, and if you're like me, like a book nerd or whatever,
yeah.
then I get so, I just want to know what everything means, and I get bogged down in that kind of thing. I think it's more fun for me to read from the Marseille deck because there's less information, but there's more you can. No, I won't put a value judgment, but I will say about the. When I was researching the chariot card,
yes,
what I found really interesting, I got fascinated with his armor, and he's got these two moons on his shoulders, one frowning and one smiling. And I read in Rider-Waite's book, he compared it to he called it Jachin and Boaz. Boaz and Jachin.
The pillars in Freemasonry?
Yeah, yeah. And also he compared it to the jeweled chest plate that the old Jewish priests used to wear when they would consult God. And okay. I got really fascinated with that because there's only one mention of it in the Bible. But I remember when I was a kid, sorry to go off on a tangent.
No, please.
When I was a kid, my parents used to read to me Christian fables and stuff, although were illustrated, you know, and they would show the Pharisees with these chest plates. And that to me was the most interesting part of the story. I was like, what is the deal with those chest plates? Is right. that armor or is that a computer?
Wow. you know? Right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
It turned out that there are these jewels on this chest plate. They used to consult when they'd ask God a question, depending on how the light shone through the jewels, it would be a yes or no answer, right? And so that he was equating to those yes or no on his shoulders. But also I heard recently that Darth Vader, then maybe this is why I connected with it, because I liked Star Wars when I was a kid. Yeah. Darth Vader has that chest plate.
Whoa, shit, that's cool.
Right? Darth Vader has that same...
Is that intentional?
It was intentional. So what I heard is it was intentional, and there's actually Hebrew on his, if you look at the costume. Now, maybe I may be wrong. Someone told me this recently.
Whoa.
Yeah, whoever designed his costume designed him to be like a Pharisee.
I love this.
Yeah.
But because, no, this is to me what my, what I'm not even, I, you can even say I dabble in this stuff, especially after talking to you. I just think it's cool.
Yeah.
And like, I love to look at tarot cards and think about it. But one of the things that makes it so attractive to me is that this, these symbols have, every single one of these symbols is like a fine wine that's been sort of fermenting in stories and philosophies for so long.
Yeah.
And we don't know exactly what vineyard these grapes came from is what's interesting. And then to make it even more mysterious, it continues to get threaded in to every piece of popular culture. It's if it's in Star Wars, it's everywhere, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that to me is really curious that it's, this is, and this is in the satanic panic. This was what they said was happening. The Satanists are putting their symbols inside every motherfucking thing, man. You know, and of course I don't believe that, that this is evil at all.
Yeah.
But I do think that the, it has a personality, right? Whatever it is, it has a personality. And its personality is to hide. Its personality is to hide in plain sight.
Hide in plain sight. Yeah, that's the thing. What was I going to say? Oh, that reminds me of when I was working on Adventure Time and someone wrote me an email, a guy who was a Mason, Freemason?
Yeah.
Or he was part of, no, he was a Rosicrucian, I think.
Okay.
And he wrote me an email because I was putting occult symbols in Adventure Time and he told me to stop. And he was like, don't share this stuff. And it's sacred and dangerous.
Can you hold on a second?
Yeah.
You know, man, that's such an interesting thing.
Yeah.
That there's somebody out there. Number one, it's cool to know that Rosicrucians are watching Adventure Time.
I think his kid was watching Adventure Time.
He's watching it with his kid. He's wearing some like robe in a, in a chamber with incense burning. And he's like, wait. Joshua, turn away.
Yeah.
I must write. Did he write it like the letters?
He wrote it in a very, he wrote it in a very heavy handed way.
Typed or handwritten?
No, he wrote me an email.
Email.
Yeah. And I told him that all that stuff is there. It's already there. Everyone can, has access to it. There's no secrets anymore, really, as far as I know.
Did he write back to you?
No, he didn't write back to me. I said everything I,
you just found like a dead crow laying in your car seat.
Yeah. Everything I put in Adventure Time, you can find on a Led Zeppelin album cover. You know, it's already been exposed.
Well, I'm sure Led Zeppelin got in trouble for that too.
Yeah, they did. Yeah,
I think so. And that is the other, that, I mean, one thing that you hear again and again when it comes to this stuff is keep a secret.
Yeah.
Don't talk about it.
Yeah.
We don't talk about it because something about in the old days, there was power in that. And I think a lot of it's probably, they don't realize the, why the element of secrecy is there. But I think a lot of it had to do with self-preservation. I mean, this, these cards survived through a time period where they were incinerating people for talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
There was a, one of the, in this book I read about Genghis Khan, they talked about how the Mongols, when they finally made it into Europe, what they found shocking was that people were forced to worship one religion. They thought that was the weirdest fucking thing. And that's Genghis Khan. You know, he was like, this is crazy. So this is a, so I think maybe a lot of the secrecy comes more from a kind of evolution, a survival mechanism that happened.
Maybe. I've been really struggling with this idea of secrecy for about maybe 2 years and the value of secrets and whether or not that has value or whether or not it used, I think it did have value at some point and whether or not it has value now, because guys like Arthur Edward Waite, so full of secrets. He writes whole books and you don't get anything out of them because he's so secretive.
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating trying to read his material because his books are just criticisms of other people's research and almost no insight into his own thoughts. It's just purely outward. He's like, if you know me, I might let you know what I know. You know, that's sort of his attitude. Well,
you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, there is one of the verses is don't disturb people with this information. It's just I can't remember exactly how the verse goes, but the idea is, look, if somebody isn't ready for this, don't bug them. Don't become a missionary. Don't like blast them with this.
That's true. But if you are going out of your way to read their book and their book gives you nothing, what is the deal with that?
Well, that's what we call a ripoff.
Yeah. But I've read other people analyzing his books and then I get illuminated, you know, then I understand where he's coming from, at least in part. I'm reading this guy, what's his name? Robert. It was in a book with Joseph Campbell and him. Oh, shoot. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But they co-wrote a book on the tarot together. And his breakdown of Arthur Edward Waite's ideas is really helpful, because if you just read Arthur Edward Waite's books, they're impenetrable.
Well, do you know...
For me.
another way to look at the idea of like keeping some of this stuff secret.
Yeah.
You know what just happened in Yellowstone, right?
No.
So in Yellowstone, they have signs
that
are like, don't go off this path.
Yeah.
If you go off this path and you stumble in one of these pools, you will die in the most horrific way.
Yeah.
In the most horrific way, one of the most horrific ways you can on this planet.
Yeah.
Being boiled alive.
Yeah, sure.
By nature.
Yeah.
So recently this kid with his sister, they wanted to do something called, there's a name for it that doesn't sound entirely pleasant, called hot popping, or like hot potatoing or something. It's where you go to unauthorized hot springs and sit in it.
Yeah, yeah.
So they wander off the trail at night. They go to this, they find a pool.
Mm-hmm.
He's standing at the edge of it. And there's signs everywhere.
Yeah.
He's standing at the edge of it. I guess he like wants to see if it's how hot it is, to see if he could sit in it.
Yeah.
Puts his hand in it.
Yeah.
Stumbles in to boiling water, boiling acid.
Yeah.
She's filming the whole thing.
Oh my God, what?
The video's not out there. I looked.
Thank God.
But he, and she couldn't get his body out.
Yeah.
And so she went back and's like, yeah, you know, we went in. And you know, you've got to like, as you're going out, you've got to pass signs.
Right.
You probably pass 100 signs that say, don't go here, you'll die.
Yeah.
So she finally gets to whoever, the park ranger or whatever, and they're like, yeah, it's, you know, we're not going to get his body out tonight because a snowstorm had kicked up.
Yeah.
They came back the next day, and he had completely dissolved.
Yeah.
Nothing left except his flip-flop.
Jesus.
He had turned into brine.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there are signs everywhere. So in the same way when it comes to this stuff,
yeah,
people say that if you get too, that if you start spiraling into the singularity of knowing what this is about, you will begin to decode the fundamental, you know, fabric of the universe.
Right.
And as you do that, since you're made of the universe, you'll start to unravel yourself.
Yeah.
And then you're gone.
Right.
You'll just end up decoding yourself.
Right.
That's it.
That's the goal, though.
For many people, that's the goal.
Yeah.
Yeah, for many people, that's the goal.
Yeah.
Is that your goal?
I think that is the goal of eliminating your fear of death, right? So you probably want to accomplish that at the end of your life so you don't go too early, because you want to experience fun shit while you're here, you know? So you got to time it right.
I mean, it's a good trick. If you could do it, it's really cool. But it is a, I mean, the magic will drive you crazy.
Yeah,
I know.
I've been on the edge of that a little bit.
Talk about that.
I was doing, actually it was a really simple, Kundalini meditation that I was doing, for a while, because I was going through a heartache or whatever. And this, my healer person gave me this meditation to do, breathing in through one nose and doing this mantra and breathing out the other.
What's the mantra?
Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Jiho. And you just You do it three times.
Wahe Guru, Wahe
Guru. Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Jiho.
Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Jiho.
And you do that four, that round four times while you're holding your breath, and then you breathe through the other nose. And I did that. I was doing that for a bit until it really like clears your brain out. So it was helping me a lot because, you know, I was like really heartbroken at that time. And so I'd come out of that meditation feeling like I was riding the crest of a wave. You know, everything was blank, but I felt a momentum underneath me. And after I did that for a while, I actually had a hallucination where I was surrounded in golden light, and I was having two perspectives at the same time. I was a caterpillar, and I was hatching out of my the golden shell. I was like this golden caterpillar, and I was also seeing the golden caterpillar at the same time. So I was that thing hatching out, seeing myself and also seeing it hatching out at the same time. Mm. My hands were folded like, you know, Egyptian pharaoh or whatever. Wow. And I was like just experiencing this for a while. I was like, holy fuck. Like just, this was so cool. You know, I was really like dazzled by the experience. And then as soon as I uncrossed my hands, the vision went away and I was just normal, awake, you know? And that actually, it was a really beautiful hallucination, which I've never had that before, but it also freaked me out. And I never did that meditation afterwards. It was too much for me.
Too much.
Yeah.
See, there it is.
Yeah.
That's the thing, because you realize like, oh, I only wanted a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not ready for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a, I think that's a very, you know, that's one of the curious things about being a human being. Is we don't want it all.
Yeah.
Many people say they want it all, but when you start seeing things like that,
it fucks with your reality, man. And like it really, and you think you're brave enough to handle that, but you have to work up to it. I think.
Oh yeah.
Some people are. They're like, you know, take me out. But I'm not. I think I'm a. What are you, Earth sign? You know, I need to be grounded.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we need to function in the world.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You can't cross your arms and turn into a caterpillar yeah. and at Bank of America.
Right.
For some reason.
Yeah.
What starts happening is it's kind of, I think, a little bit of what virtual reality is going to start doing for people is it's going to give them a lesson really too quickly about the subjective nature of reality and like, mm-hmm. look, instantly you're in another place that isn't real. Now you think this place is real. And I think that, so you sort of through magic, you're starting to see this, you know, you start seeing through consensus reality. You mm-hmm. start realizing like, oh yeah. Like for example, a couple of days ago, I got stoned mm-hmm. and went to eat ramen mm-hmm. down in Pasadena. Have you been to this ramen place in Pasadena?
Which one?
God, it's called...
I haven't.
Tatsuyo Nutoto, or it's like there's okay. lines in front of it.
Okay, yeah.
And I made fun of it before. Like, my girlfriend loves ramen.
I love ramen.
I'm never going to fucking stand in line for ramen.
Yeah.
Like a fool. Like, thinking about ramen that you get at the grocery store or whatever, the terrible, like...
Sure.
Poverty cubes or whatever.
Right, yeah. You College know? Student food.
Yes.
Yeah.
But so anyway, I'm stoned and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to get some ramen. I don't know why I'm adding the ramen thing in. I guess just because like as I'm eating the ramen, it's so good that mm-hmm. it's like making me even more high. And I'm basically entering into this like very powerful altered state
yeah.
at this ramen place.
Yeah.
And but then, so I'm in this great mood. And then right across from the ramen place I didn't need to tell the ramen part of the story. Sure. I could have cut that out completely. But God, Jesus, I'm really in a ramen kick right now.
I love ramen, man.
The best. And the synergy between ramen and edible marijuana is unlike anything on it. So
gotta try it.
I decided to cross the street to an Anthropology for no reason. I'm just going to walk into the Anthropology. So talking about like the weirdness of consensus reality and mm-hmm. manufactured realities.
Yeah.
A store is a manufactured reality mm-hmm. where some corporate psychologists have gotten together to try to create a temple mm-hmm. of capital. That is a temple. When you go into a store, mm-hmm. you are entering into a temple that worships a god. And yeah. the god the temple worships is whatever the particular name of the store is. So yeah. Anthropology is a god yeah. that's been summoned up by a corporation.
Yeah.
And the form the god takes is the various products. You could say the god of anthropology is the sum total of all the fucking lip balms and little floral baggies and candles that smell like pumpkin pie. And like it all adds together. And then you walk in to this reality bubble. That's what a store is. It's a fucking reality bubble.
Yeah.
The music, the way that the people in there are being forced to act, the way they're being forced to dress, the people who work there.
Yeah.
Those are the priests.
Yeah.
When you walk into a retail store, you are in the presence of high priests who are worshiping an entity that they summoned up through their shared attention, and it takes the form of a fucking anthropology, right? And you can feel the spirit itself. In the same way, if you go to a Hare Krishna temple, you can feel the spirit of something in
there. I feel that when I go to Moon Juice.
What's Moon Juice?
It's a juice and other stuff. Everything's super expensive, and the people treat you like you just walked into church.
Yes.
When you go in there.
I've heard of this place. Is that place in Venice? Is that Moon Juice?
There's one in Silver Lake.
This is what... So you start getting into this stuff, hidden in plain sight, and you begin to realize, well, I mean, this is like one of my favorite Daniel Johnston lyrics.
Yeah.
It goes, there are strange secret cults in every town.
I don't know that song.
It's a great song.
Do you know what song it is?
Oh, God. I think it's either Don't Play Cards with Satan.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, it's a long way of getting to a point, which is that we think we're living in a normal, mythology-free, non-occult world.
Right.
We think in the old days, sure, there were like people in robes and incense and worshiping weird gods in the days of Babylon.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's all gone now.
Yeah.
No! Go to downtown Pasadena, walk into an anthropology, and you have entered into a temple where a magical ritual is going on from probably 11 a.m., 10 a.m. to 9 p.m.
Yeah.
And that magical ritual is the conversion of your life energy in the form of money.
Yeah.
And in exchange, you get scented candles and like, not only that though.
Yeah.
You get a chance to experience the perfect life.
Right.
You know, when you walk in,
it's
like...
But it's also mundane at the same time, you know. That, and that's the way that I think about Catholic church. When you go to a Catholic ceremony, it's so mundane. When you go, I'm bored to tears when I go to one of those things.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's right beneath the surface, it's... fucking insane.
Well, that's why you got to get stoned when you go to church.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as like, yeah, stoner talk, man, let's get stoned when you go to church.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, I mean, that's probably the way they used to do it. It's like you need some kind of psychedelic as the sacrament when you enter into the space to open your mind. And then you really will start picking up. But you don't have to go to Catholic church. Yeah. We are living in an age of, you could even say this is the most occult age. This is we are in the most occult laden, I don't know how you'd say it. We are in an age.
Imbued with.
Occult imbued age.
Yeah.
You're putting symbols into a cartoon that we don't know their origination point, that have been used in secret rituals for thousands of years, to the point where Rosicrucians are writing you emails.
Right. Well, I felt like I had a duty to do that, actually. It was this opportunity that I couldn't pass up. I felt like I had to put magic in that show, like real magic, things that you could do.
How many seasons did you work on that show?
I worked from the end of season one until end of season seven. So any opportunity I had to put something in there that would make a kid think like, maybe that could be real. Maybe I could really do this ceremony or this kind of thing, or put symbols in there that had deep ancient meaning.
You're not worried about saying, I mean, this is going to end up on... What you're saying will more than likely end up on some kind of...
It's fine. It's fine. I think I've said this before somewhere. But because I was reacting, I felt like maybe I won't have a chance to do this again, work on a hit show, you know? Everything I do after Adventure Time will be some underground thing, something, you know, occult, more occult niche, you know, because I feel like I'm a niche person. I don't feel like I have... I feel like I shouldn't say this if executives are listening, but I feel like, which I don't think they are, but maybe they are. I don't know. But I think of myself as a niche person. So I had this opportunity to work on this accidentally hit show, and I was reacting against the materialism that I felt was so prevalent in my circle of people I associate with. The people, progressive left, basically, that's the people I hang out with. And within that community, I felt anecdotally, I don't think this is always true, especially not so much in LA. I think LA is more a weirdo place where people are allowed to believe weird shit, you know? But everywhere outside of that, if you tell someone, like my friends back in Philly, I tell them about 5 years ago, I started getting into tarot, and they just give me a weird look like I'm crazy, you know, like I'm wasting my time, basically. And that's the attitude, this materialist, what do you call it? Not anecdotal, the opposite of empirical belief system. And I was using this cartoon in part to tell funny stories and stuff, but also to push my personal agenda of pushing magic into the world and that people assume that magic is real in this
world. What's an example of something in Adventure Time that has its roots in magic that you put there?
There was a location spell that Peppermint Butler used to travel through the astral plane to find his nemesis or whatever. And I based his, I can't remember the quote exactly, but I based his spell based on an Aleister Crowley quote, you know?
Wow. And,
you know, something he was like really like saying some statement about, you know, above and below and all that kind of stuff. And
as above, so below.
Yeah. I don't know if that was in there. Oh, I've had Magic Man say that, you know, the old hermetic idea or whatever. So things like that, I just wanted to put in the show casually, not call so much attention to them, but have this magic there that kids could take for granted and not, you know, question. Because I think that magic happens all the time, and we are so cynical of when those things happen, when those moments happen, that we brush them aside. As soon as they happen, we might have an aha moment, you know, this magical moment. I can't explain what just happened, some phenomenon that just happened. And then I immediately go back to that consensus materialist reality and just treat that like a dream.
Man, you know? I'll tell you what just happened to me, because I think that's an important thing. I think, didn't Crowley say you should talk about it if it works? Like, that's the one thing you shouldn't keep a secret, or you should announce that this spell has worked, or that an experiment has worked. Maybe I'm mistaking something I read somewhere else, but
yeah, I think that's a good.
A friend of mine recently, needed to borrow like $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, yeah, that's cool, because this is somebody I love, and like, yeah, no problem helping you out. So gave him $1,500. And then the next day, I went to my mailbox, and there was a completely unexpected check in my mailbox for $1,498.
Yeah.
Almost the exact amount that I'd given to this person. And to me, that's like, that's magic. I mean, it's not that I don't get checks in the mail sometimes, but it's like certainly not the exact amount that I just gave to somebody. And you say that to the materials, and they're like, you remember the hits. Yeah. We remember the hits.
Think
of all the times you've given people stuff and you've never gotten the exact same money. You just remember that fucking coincidence.
Yeah. It might be a coincidence, but I really think it all depends on how you think about that stuff. Like, it comes down to, I've been trying to do this, not just study the tarot, but slowly trying to radiate that out into the real world. So I don't know. It's not an original idea, but I think the world, I try to think of the world as a living tarot and interpret everything that's happening around me as symbols.
Yes.
You know, and the one moment that really sticks out to me was this moment when this is some Hollywood shit, but I like went to an agency. I was thinking about getting an agent.
Yeah.
And I went to this big cartoon agency, and I had a meeting with these two guys, and they were selling me on stuff I didn't want. they were saying, you can make the next Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I enjoyed that movie, but that's not what I want to make. You know, I don't want to make Cloudy. I want to make weird shit that shocks people or whatever, you know? But I was giving that to myself. And the whole time they were like, we were such big fans. That's what they always say. We're such big fans of your work, blah, blah, blah. And I had this weird feeling in my stomach. And I didn't know how to interpret it because I felt like maybe these guys could help me. And maybe they wanted to help me. Maybe they really liked my work. Yeah. I don't know. And so after the meeting, I sort of felt good about it and sort of mixed, but cautious, you know? And then I got in the elevator, and this is right when I was really starting to get into researching the tarot and thinking about the idea of the world tarot or whatever, the world around you being interpreted as symbols. And I went down a floor to the lobby, but for some reason the elevator stopped. And I guess maybe someone there had accidentally hit a button or something before me. So I stopped on the floor below their level, and the doors opened, and it was a black hallway. It was all the lights were out, and I walked into the hallway, and well, immediately I was like, "What's going on? Like this is like I felt like this was a magic moment or something." I walked into the dark hallway, and then the light sensors turned on, and there was a huge roach on the wall, and I immediately was like, I'm not working with these guys. Wow. And I walked out on the elevator and went home. Cool. And I just never called them again. Because that symbol, something about this, you know, that David Lynch Blue Velvet, you know, when it goes into the grass in the first scene in that movie. Yes. And there's like this idyllic suburban place. And then it goes deep into the grass. Yeah. And there are these insects like fighting each other. Yeah. And that's how I felt. I had gone the level below them and saw like this underbelly, this toxic underbelly, you know, or something like that. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to rip on those guys. Maybe they were nice guys, but that was my that activated something that I already felt in me, but I wasn't acknowledging.
Yeah, right.
And so it wasn't like it was illuminating something that was already there. And that's how I also feel about tarot cards. I don't try to read the future or anything like that. I just try to understand myself through them.
Right. Yeah. We were talking on the phone about this, if you want to change the color of a fountain, mm-hmm. you don't try to dye the drops coming out. You mm-hmm. would start at the base of the fountain, which is the present moment. The future comes from the present. So shining a light on whatever the particular pattern is that it's more like you're shining a light on the I guess you could say the window or the lantern that is yourself that's projecting a world into this dimension and seeing what the formations are at that moment with the tarot, because something's going to stick out with every single card. Like I could just randomly pick any card at all. The two of swords. Tell me what this means.
I mean, it really depends on the question,
just the symbols. What are the,
there's like two is duality, so it could be about a decision being made, between choices or something or split, or it could also mean two people coming together, two opposites. And there's a, this one is interesting because it's the Weight, and I don't read from the Weight, but it's like a blind lady sitting on a bench. And I'm sure this is imbued with tons of meaning. There's a moon. So that means like, sort of like a more, receptive intelligence and, I don't know. It really depends on what the question is.
Well, I would think just from what you're saying, it makes me think of like an impending thing I'm doing. I'm moving to New York. Yeah. So like I apply that stuff like, decisions and dualities and to the unknown. She's blindfolded. I don't know what's going to happen. But the point is like any of these things can like help you begin to excavate, and then you can get even lower and deeper, and then you start hitting, the fear place through these cards. You can start like banging up against the thing you're trying to ignore with the cards, which is always uncomfortably awesome.
Actually, that makes me remember now that the reason why I started doing that World Tarot kind of like idea was because actually was influenced by my parents, who were super Christian when I was growing up, and they were always communicating with what they called God, and God was giving them signs all the time. They would see signs on license plates and stuff like that, and they would make their decisions based on those things. You know,
yeah,
like where to move or that. And my mom, I remember, almost got hit by a car one time. And then she saw a license plate that was like a vanity plate or something, said blue something. And she was like, oh, we got to move to the Blue Ridge Mountains. Something like that. You know, that was God telling me that.
I love that.
Yeah, I love that too. That, you know, that's that, I grew up with that. So that way of logic makes sense to me. It seemed to work for my, I could see it working for them in a practical way, in a pragmatic way. And so it's that thing where if it works, just do it. You know, it doesn't have to make sense within your peer group. You know,
depending on who your peer group is. Well, then if your peer group is the one that you're using to make your decisions, then your peer group's a fucking vanity license plate.
Yeah.
You know, if that's what you're using, if like you're, then that's your God.
Yeah,
I mean, this is one of the, In the Bhagavad Gita, this is one of the verses I actually was going to put into the last episode. It's for chapter 7 is my favorite chapter in the Bhagavad Gita currently. Mm-hmm. And chapter 7 is Krishna saying, those who worship the demigods, go to the demigods. And whatever it is that you place your attention upon, that thing I will become, basically, is what God says.
Yeah.
So I will, your God, whatever it may be, is like a swimming pool inflatable raft.
Right.
And what it gets inflated with is the energy of Krishna.
Yeah.
And so the form that it takes, whether it's a fucking statue of Buddha, or whether it's an anthropomorph. Or whether it's your lover, or your job, or your career, or your fear of death, or your identity as an atheist, or your identity as a theist, the energy in with that's holding it up, is Krishna, taking on. I was like, oh, you want me to wear this costume? Okay,
that makes a lot of sense.
So it's cool, and I think that when you begin to free yourself, like you're saying, from this the terrible manacles of worrying about what your fucking goddamn intellectual friends think.
Yeah.
Whether what they think is for better or for worse, that's their thing and it's fine. But Jesus, God help you.
Yeah.
God help you if you're letting the opinions of people around you. Because, you know, the thing is, like, look into yourself. I mean, you might not be a confused person, but I'm fucking a lot of the time.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
Unbelievably confused.
Yeah. I'm confused a lot.
Just confused. And then when I contemplate like notions of myself, who am I? What am I? What's going on here?
Yeah.
Like, who do I think I am?
Right.
And then that always gets very confusing.
Yeah.
So that's how I feel. And when I've talked, and now you say you're confused sometimes.
Sure. Yeah. Deep confusion.
And then when I talk to like some of my closest friends, they are definitely fucking confused.
I think there are people who are much more confused than me, but
yes,
but like to a debilitating degree.
So when you realize the odds are pretty good.
Yeah.
That person who's like laying down the materialist POV on your ass. Secretly at night, as he's falling asleep or she's falling asleep or whatever, she's freaking the fuck out too.
Right.
I don't know what I am. You know what I mean? I know I'm depressed.
Yeah.
I know I have to, I don't feel depressed, but a lot, like, I remember just talking to a materialist friend, and I'm not saying there's any kind of correlation here.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we got in this whole conversation about the validity of science versus what we're talking about, and like, you know, the usual. It was exciting for me. I like getting smackdowns from the materialists.
I get smackdown from materialists quite a bit. Yeah.
But then towards the end of the smackdown, you know, he was talking about how many fucking medications he's on,
right?
Because of his terrible, terrible depression.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, not to say that you're materialism or atheism is making you depressed or mm-hmm. whatever, but the whatever the thing is that you are worshiping is clearly maybe not creating the kind of harmony in your life that you would like necessarily, if yeah. that thing that you're worshiping is the very surface level of the universe, which is a quite beautiful thing.
Yeah.
The atoms, the deepest levels, the quarks, the mm-hmm. then this fundamentally mysterious things that are underneath the quarks or whatever.
Right.
That's cool, but
yeah.
I guess
they like to romanticize that. I mean, I think they should, but they a lot of them sorry. But they I hear a lot of scientists who put those investigations into a sublime context.
Yeah.
You know, in order to replace the revelation of religion or spiritual yeah. belief. And I think it's a noble effort, but I don't think that it is a direct replacement. I think that those things can exist. Those things need to exist. The material investigation is totally valuable. And I value it highly, and I respect the people who that's their thing. You know what I mean? But I think that it can't replace revelation. It can't replace that energy fill that you get from having a transcendental experience.
You know what Alex Gray calls it?
Yeah.
I'm going to say it wrong. A theophany?
Okay, yeah.
You know, like a sudden realization of God, or a sudden mm-hmm. realization of a spirit mm-hmm. that is not impersonal.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. There's nothing better than that, man. There's yeah. nothing better than...
Even frightening, as frightening as that, or as, you know what I mean, as awesome, awe-inspiring as that, you know?
Well, it's a game of hide and seek with Krishna.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I love the symbol of Krishna, because it's a little, you know, it's a boy, most of the time, a little kid, and you're a little kid too. And this whole thing is like a fantastic game of hide and seek with the unit, with that which all things originate from, mm-hmm. and it's hiding inside itself right in front of you, in your friends, in your dogs, in your cats, in moments of intuition where mm-hmm. you have some great realization. I love that. That makes me so happy. Yeah. And then I love praying to it, yeah. and I love thinking about it, and I love I've been doing this so much more lately too. Going to bed praying, waking up praying, and then doing prayers for the confusion. You ever do that?
Prayers for confusion?
For the confusion, but when you're in the midst, like, so, okay, so like...
Yeah, I mean, like, in my most desperate moments, yeah.
Saying thank you for the... So, like, yeah. you start getting into this place where you realize, like, okay, the process is this. We'll just make it up. Let every phenomena that comes into your life mm-hmm. is like a cube of energy or something, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't have to be a cube. You make it whatever shape you want.
Sure.
So here comes, I think I'm lazy.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think I'm lazy is coming down the conveyor belt of the mind. And you, as this alchemist, as it comes down, can actually instantly transform it by being like, thank you, God, for letting me have a mind that can be aware that I think I'm lazy. Thank you just for that experience of being able to think that I'm lazy. Thank mm-hmm. you just for that. Thank you, God, for this experience of when you get paranoid. Thank you, God, for this experience of paranoia, for giving me the ability to protect myself yeah. in this way, or to think. But you just start focusing. So it immediately takes your mind off the weighty, always ever-changing, never-ending,
right.
like a cat with a laser light being shined at you yeah. from the universe. It immediately moves your eyes from the laser point to that which is shining the laser.
Right. I've never done that.
It feels great. It's a really... You'll forget to do it.
Yeah.
But because I had this dream where I was... I was in... It was a really cool dream, but in the dream I was like just walking in a field or something in some dream place. And I started saying weird gratitude prayers.
Uh-huh.
And when I did that, this energetic form would like appear over my head that looked like the top of a mosque or something.
Okay.
Like just like, you know, archetypical, like sacred geometry. Just
yeah.
whoosh, like immediately just form. It's like, oh, like whenever I say thank you to the universe, it makes these things appear mm-hmm. in dreamland. So anyway, I've been doing that experiment with some... with a lot of success.
Oh, that's
and
good.
When you don't feel like saying thank you even say thank you there too. Like, you can just start thanking the universe for every single thing.
I think I forget to do that a lot, actually.
Easy to forget.
Yeah. I think because I'm in a constant state of protecting myself, you know? So it's hard to, when the hits come, it's hard to turn that around and like you do, like thank your consciousness for being able to even register that kind of stuff, the paranoia and that anxiety.
Well, yeah, I was reading in this Houston Smith book, mm-hmm. there's like all these, I guess, aspects of God, mm-hmm. or perfect aspects of God. And one of them, the things which are good, mm-hmm. fundamentally good. What is fundamentally good? And one of the things, in according to this, that is fundamentally good, mm-hmm. is existence, mm-hmm. itself. Fundamentally good to exist. It is, yeah. better to exist than not to exist. So it's right. fundamentally good to exist. So just that creates a baseline to give thanks for. Just, yeah. okay, I just get to feel this now. This is incredible. You know, can I read something to you?
Sure, yeah.
Have you ever read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning?
No.
Okay, check this out, man. I'm going to read this to you really quick. So this is like a guy who is in Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And he's being like marched, mm-hmm. in the morning on some kind of death march. Mm-hmm. And he's like standing next to somebody else. They're being marched to do work in the cold by fucking Nazis. A man marching next to me whispered suddenly, "If our wives could see us now, I do hope they're better off in their camps and don't know what is happening to us." Mm-hmm. That brought thoughts of my own wife to mind. And as we stumbled on for miles, slipping on icy spots, supporting each other time and again, dragging one another up and onward, nothing was said, but we both knew each of us was thinking of his wife. Occasionally, I looked at the sky where the stars were fading and the pink light of the morning was beginning to spread behind a dark bank of clouds, but my mind clung to my wife's image, imagining it with an uncanny acuteness. I heard her answering me, saw her smile, her frank and encouraging look. Real or not, her look was then more luminous than the sun, which was beginning to rise. A thought transfixed me. For the first time in my life, I saw the truth as it is set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as the final wisdom by so many thinkers. The truth. That love is the ultimate and highest goal to which men can aspire. Then I grasped the meaning of the greatest secret that human poetry and human thought and belief have to impart. The salvation of man is through love and in love. I understood how a man who has nothing left in this world still may know bliss, be it only for a brief moment, in the contemplation of his beloved, in a position of utter desolation, when man cannot express himself in positive action, when his only achievement may consist in enduring his sufferings in the right way, mm-hmm. an honorable way. In such a position, man can, through loving contemplation of the image he carries of his beloved, achieve fulfillment. Mm-hmm. For the first time in my life, I was able to understand the meaning of the words, "The angels are lost in perpetual contemplation of an infinite glory."
Yeah, that's how I've been feeling a lot lately about, you know, all the shit that's been going on with, now I don't want to get too deep into the,
it's okay. Go ahead.
No, I feel like I'm going to dig myself a grave because,
you're going to talk, everyone's been talking about Westworld on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, I really think that dude is a robot. that cowboy.
No, go ahead.
It's that, this is that thing that he's talking about is the thing I've been trying to achieve in myself for I guess since my mid-20s, is this, and in the Bhagavad Gita they call it the three gunas, right?
Yes.
Is it gunas or junas or?
I've heard it pronounced goons.
Yeah, yeah.
But I always say gunas. You could say.
Okay, but you know what I'm talking about. The,
it's probably junas. Who knows? Right. Whatever. The three modes.
The three modes. One being chaos, right? And like being lost in the tides of your environment, like how being completely affected by everything that happens around you, being like having no power,
mode of ignorance.
Yeah. And then the other one is being being on the roller coaster of life, having those highs and lows.
Yes.
And which is in the state that most people are in, right?
Yes.
that are like normal functioning people.
Mode of passion.
Yeah, mode of passion. Where, and then the highest mode, which is you're easily toppled from once you acknowledge that you're in that mode or whatever, yeah. is
goodness.
Right. Is being this, that Buddhist, whatever, compassionate detachment where you're not affected by the hurricanes of life.
Yes.
You know? And to me, like that third one is the one I really try, have been slowly working towards, in order to tame my reality, you know, and not be bowled over when a guy, you know, horrible, like homophobic, you know, like Mexican hating president becomes our president. I'm not walking around completely fucked
and surrounds himself with like a cabinet of just monsters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, so I've seen, like, this is just this thing that I've seen from my friends as an example of that description, you know, of where you walk into a cafe and you're like, how's your day going? And they're like, how do you think?
Yeah.
And then you have to participate in that drama.
Well, you have to help them not worship the demigod. It's like,
right.
Cause when we worship a demigod, we don't just worship the demigod through like giving the demigod flowers or pouring honey on some statue. Well, the way we worship the demigod that is Trump is with our fear, our anxiety, our terror,
right.
Our
you're nervous. Feeding that fire.
You're feeding, what you are doing every single moment of your life that is clouded by fear, you are sacrificing that moment to Trump. You are giving that moment on the altar of time to this being that you've created in your mind that you think Trump is. Yeah. Whatever he may be, doesn't seem like a sweetheart. A lot of what he's doing, he fucking assigned the attorney general is this like rabid hater of marijuana. It was really, you know, and all the other things. Okay, fine. But this is... So to get back to the idea of the gunas.
Yeah.
So the idea is these three modes interact, not just within a person, but in nature too. So this is a constant dance that's happening between these three energetic states, essentially. And the idea is that even the mode of goodness is still just a temporary mode, and that it is the transcendent fixation on the thing behind the modes that is the true pathway to liberation. So even being in the mode of goodness, you know, sitting on drinking green tea in your cabin, in your sustainable cabin with solar panels and your beautiful garden compost pile, no waste. Even in that place, if you have not connected to the transcendent, then you're still going to be in you're still in a bit of a precarious position. But it's the so it's like seeing as absolutely blasphemous as a thing as this is to say, Trump is Krishna.
Yeah,
Trump is God. His cabinet. Yeah. You know what I mean?
For sure. Man.
This is a manifestation of the divine on Earth, and then within that. You know, and we've all been given a wonderful riddle.
Yeah.
Crack the code. How do you love him? You know, how do you
figure out? Yeah, for sure. I think that's the answer. I really think like everyone's coming. I mean, everyone in the echo chamber of Facebook echo chamber is coming out. Everyone that we know who we all talk to and all interact with, who completely ignores the other side. We all just riot in anger, you know, and we don't. Participate in the other side of the coin, you know?
And our anger is scared anger, so it's the worst kind of anger, too. A lot of the anger that people are displaying isn't Martin Luther King anger, because his anger was filled with love.
Yeah.
And they talk about Neem Karoli Baba when he got angry. It was just love. It was his anger was love. This is a scared, petty anger, where people are holding up signs that say, you know, rape Melania Trump, or like, you know,
I didn't see that.
Yeah, that people are doing that, or people are like, you know, some people are making up fake stories about attacks is an attempt to like in some way or another demonstrate the world that we're now entering into. Now I think there are real fucking attacks that are probably happening too, but if there's a sum total of humans on the planet whose idea is let's figure out a way to create a more perfect union, right? And that's a really beautiful idea. A more perfect union. How can we harmonize in even better, more accelerated, advanced ways with the people around us? The way to do that is not to lie. The way to do that is not to become the thing that you hate. So anyway, and also the way to do it is like, come on, man, we got to see past this too. To love Trump doesn't mean you don't fight every step of the fucking way. If his assholes start doing stupid things, there's so many beautiful methods in place, you know, to help to fight this. You know, there's lots of ways that if stuff emerges that we need to fight, that we can fight.
Yeah.
So that's there for us. It's just, but as we're doing that, I'm doing the thing where I say we. I hate it when I do that. I think that's another thing, is this fucking collectivization in language where you start doing like, what we must do.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know.
That drives me crazy. I feel so conflicted about that, actually, because I guess I'm supposed to share, like be empathetic and less individualistic or something. I'm supposed to be communing with my fellow brothers, you know? But also I'm like, at the same time, I'm like, you don't represent my nuanced thoughts. Like what you say isn't exactly me. That's how I felt about, that's how I felt about, because I'm half Japanese, and there was this thing, not to change the subject, but there was this thing on Twitter when I was actually paying attention to Twitter a long time ago. There was this thing, where this lady online was saying, cancel Colbert or whatever. Do you remember when that happened?
No.
She was an Asian lady because Colbert made an Asian joke.
Yes, I remember.
That actually was making fun of people making Asian jokes, but within the context of an Asian joke. That's my memory of it. And so she tried to start this online Twitter thing against him to get him fired. And she said, I forget what it was, but it was something like, I'll say, cancel Colbert. And I was like, why are you representing all Asians? Like, I'm not you. You're not me. Like, you're not speaking for me, but you're acting as if you are by saying we and this kind of stuff, like saying all Asians feel this way.
Yeah.
And I was more insulted by her assertion that she spoke for me.
It's obnoxious.
It's crazy obnoxious. But I was like, I got so angry at that.
What I love about what Viktor Frankl wrote about, and I love about the concept of theism or God, is that it gives you this blasphemous ability to, in the face of whatever the horror is, because Viktor Frankl, you're getting marched by Nazis. It can't get much worse than that.
Yeah, that's the worst.
And even in the midst of that, he's feeling this transcendental love.
Yeah.
For the beloved.
Yeah.
And the beloved doesn't have, for him, it was his wife.
Yeah.
But this is, I think, one of the gifts that this stuff that we're talking about gives you, is it lets you lift your eyes from the human level to something far, far greater, and something that will last, something that won't go away. And when you do that, the idea is like, okay, from this platform, I can really do good in the world.
Yeah.
If there's a fight against Trump or whatever, I can, from here, I can react with confidence. Whereas from the human level, it becomes so frightening and pointless and ridiculous.
And repetitive and, you know, redundant drama that keeps happening over and over again. And that, what that book that you're talking about, that's sort of for me that the highest goal of like where I want to be able to get to be in a situation of pure horror and be calm and be observing the sublime in that moment. Like if I can get to that courageous point, that's where I wish I could get, could get to. And that's, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I will or not, but
Well, the next time you, what I do, what I like to do is when I am in a particularly shit spot throughout the day, whatever it may be, that's where I'm like, oh wait, can I find, if I can remember. So I have a mnemonic trick. Mm-hmm. So if I'm really feeling bad, I ask, well, what am I forgetting? What am I forgetting? Because most of the time what I'm forgetting is that God is inside everything. Mm. So when I'm feeling really bad, I'll be like, what am I forgetting? What am I forgetting here? And then it's like, oh shit, I forgot again. Okay. Can I find it here? Can I find it in this moment here with a pulsating doom hangover?
Yeah.
Can I find it here? And then you start doing the, so now at least it gives you a game to play inside the horror. Mm-hmm. Because instead of being in the horror, which is to react to whatever the thing is.
Right.
And then you're reacting to it. It gives you a mini game to play inside of, which is like, wait a minute. Like what you said, where is the, in this tarot card?
Yeah.
Where is the wisdom?
Yeah, yeah.
Where is the love or the, for me, it's God. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, and if you find it, then bam, instant transformation of the experience. Mm-hmm.
And that's also going to, that's also going to affect the way you interact with other people. I hope, you know, the way you treat other people who have different opinions, have had different experiences than you, who have different things that they're rallying against. You can find that common light.
And they can feel it.
Yeah. And then it doesn't, then they don't give a shit about what you think about some material world drama. You know,
they
acknowledge you as a human being, as a living being.
They know you're seeing past whatever the thing is into the deeper thing.
And I like to make friends with those people who have really different views.
Me too.
From me. Yeah.
They're the best.
I have a friend, Seth, who's like a conservative Republican, and I love talking to that guy.
They're the best to talk to.
Yeah.
Because you learn that you can't be in the filter bubble, man. You got to get out of the filter bubble. If you get stuck in that fucking thing, you will get so lost. And it doesn't matter because you're not doing it. It's from that. I saw the preview of that movie you were talking about. What it's called?
Oh, Hypernormalization.
Yeah, where it shows all the computer servers that, and you know, like the stock footage that always represents tweets coming into a server.
Yeah.
Flickering lights that are. It's like you've transformed your outrage into flickering lights on a server somewhere. Then those flickering lights are being filtered so that your tweets are only going to people who agree with you anyway.
Yeah.
So who fucking cares?
Right.
Go yell your outrage it's in insane. A hole.
Yeah.
Might as well. Go dig a fucking hole and scream about
but
how
it
much
feels
hate.
Good. It feels good to do that because it's like you're getting feedback from a mirror. You're just looking at yourself and screaming and feeling good about it.
It feels great.
Yeah.
The likes feel good.
Yeah, the likes feel good, man.
And that's how we're going to end right there.
Okay, sure.
That's our final. This is the final.
Give me some likes.
This is the true realization that comes from the great esoteric wisdom of the ages. It's nice to get likes on Twitter.
It is nice.
Man, this has been.
Although I had to quit Twitter because I couldn't take
can't
it.
Can't do it. Have you been watching Black Mirror?
No.
Okay, you got to watch the first episode of the latest season of Black Mirror. I'm not going to go, but the premise is it's a world where you can rate every interaction you have.
Oh, Jesus.
So when people pass other people, they like click their phone to give them like likes.
Yeah.
But if you have a low score on this thing, you will like have trouble getting a good apartment.
Right.
You know what I mean? It fucks you up. You can't get a good job.
Yeah.
It's really cool. Anyway, look, man, you're the best. How can people find you?
My website with jessemoynihan.com. That's where I update my comics and I have blogs and all that kind of stuff on there.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Man, you should give a tarot card class.
I still need to take tarot card classes, I think.
Well, you know, they say the best way to learn is to teach.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Man,
that's true.
If you took one, I would sign up in a heartbeat. Think about it. All right, cool. Thank you very much,
All right, Jesse. Thanks, Duncan.
That was Jesse Moynihan, everybody. If you like Jesse, why don't you go to his website, jessemoynihan.com. Much thanks to MeUndies.com for sponsoring this episode. Go to MeUndies.com/Duncan to get 20% off a brand new pair of underwear. Be sure to give us a nice rating on iTunes. Use our Amazon link. Subscribe to us and subscribe to the idea that you're surrounded by secret wisdom and you can harvest it at any moment. I'll see you guys next week. Hare Krishna.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is Julian Edelman from Dudes on Dudes with Gronk and Jules. Sunday mornings, I've got my game day ritual. Coffee, lucky socks, and now new morning Uncrustable sandwiches.
It's all about that 12-gram protein boost with the new Uncrustables Bright-Eyed Berry or Up and Apple flavors.
Bright-Eyed Berry's got a feisty receiver energy.
Up and Apple? Your classic do-it-all tight end.
Soft, pillowy, packed with protein, and easy enough for Gronk to grab from the freezer.
Whether you're on the couch, driving to the tailgate, or heading to the locker room, new morning Uncrustable sandwiches are the MVP of snacks.
Your new Sunday kickoff ritual starts here with new morning Uncrustable sandwiches packed with 12 grams of protein.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.